For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Well, tonight I'm going to be talking about the subject of morality. What makes the best account for objective moral values and duties? Theism, that is, belief in God, or naturalism? Which is it that makes better sense? That our intuition, our perception of morality came from matter and energy, or that it originated from a mind? Theologians can refer to God as an unembodied, infinite, perfect mind. And it seems to me that the best explanation for morality is that morality comes from a personal being, not from impersonal forces. Let's start by looking at a survey that was done recently. According to a survey of over 700 professional philosophers, what are the two things that the majority of these philosophers had in common? Number one, 76%, about 3 out of 4, were affirmative of naturalism. And number two, 56% believed in objective moral values and duties. So, what we're talking about here tonight is not that naturalists, people who are naturalists, cannot affirm or practice moral values and duties. In fact, many of them do, the majority. You might be saying to yourself, well, what is naturalism? Well, naturalism is just the belief, and ism is a belief system in nature, that there's nothing beyond nature. There's nothing behind nature. There's nothing above nature. All of nature is one substance. It's matter, energy. That's it. Naturalism is the affirmation that there's nothing beyond nature. So things like souls wouldn't exist in a naturalistic worldview. Persons like God wouldn't exist. So naturalism is just the belief that there is nothing outside of nature. What do we mean when we say objective? Objective is in contrast to subjective. Objective claims deal with the object, what's out there. Subjective claims deal with the subject, what I think about the object. Let me give you an example. Mint chocolate chip ice cream is green. Am I talking about the subject, myself, or am I talking about the object? Object, good. Great, three people got that. Okay, great. I'm talking about the object. I'm making a truth claim about the ice cream. Now, if I said I really like mint chocolate chip ice cream, what is that? A subjective claim. I'm speaking about the subject. So when we speak about moral values and duties in the objective sense, we're not referring to personal preference. We're not referring to the subject. We're referring to the object. Let me make this very clear. If Hitler won World War II, and he brainwashed or coerced or forced everyone to believe that Jewish people were subhuman, objectively, it would still be wrong what he did, even if everyone believed to the contrary. And so 56% of professional philosophers agree in objective moral values and duties. Sometimes just going through a list is helpful in this regard of objective moral evils. For example, torturing babies for fun. What are we saying when we say that torturing babies for fun is wrong? Are we saying, I just don't really like torturing babies for fun? That's a subjective claim. Or are we saying something about the object itself, that we're saying there's something wrong about that out there, the referent out there, that's wrong? Hunting a human being for sport, the most dangerous game, human. Are we saying, I just don't really prefer, like I'd rather hunt a cheetah or a tiger? You like to hunt humans, I guess that's your preference. No, we're saying that it's objectively wrong to do that. Racism, sexism, these are objectively wrong. Think about before African Americans were given rights through the Emancipation Proclamation. Did they have those rights before those judicial warrants were given? Were these created or were they discovered? If you're a subjective moralist, you believe that those were created, that a second before that proclamation was given, they didn't have those rights, and a second after, they did. If you believe in objective moral values and duties, you believe that they weren't created, but rather that they were discovered. Torturing babies for fun, hunting human beings for sport. Nickelback. Objectively, morally evil. Okay, that's not right. What I meant to say was people who listen to Nickelback. That guy who played Anakin Skywalker. You're like, which one? Either one. Doesn't matter. Okay, you're laughing at those last two. Why did you laugh at the last two? Because those are subjective claims. The first three are objective, the second two are subjective. So what we're doing here is we need to not only define our terms, but we're making an important qualification. The qualification is this, that naturalists, that is people who affirm naturalism, naturalists can affirm and practice objective moral values and duties. To say otherwise would be slander, would be name-calling. No one here is saying that a naturalist can't affirm and even practice moral values and duties. Of course they can. In fact, sometimes naturalists put Christians to shame in this regard. What we're saying to the contrast is this: naturalism cannot account or support objective moral values and duties. If you're a philosopher, this is the difference between epistemology, how we know these things to be true, versus ontology. What's their foundation? How do we know that it actually exists? Let me put this a different way. You don't need to believe in God to affirm objective morality. But there needs to be a God for objective morality to exist. Some of you seem to not follow still, so I'll give you a very clever illustration. Are you ready? You're sitting with your friends later tonight. You're palling around. You're hanging out. And you're like, bro, what should we do? And he's like, bro, let's just do something fun. And you're like, bro, are you thinking what I'm thinking? And he's like, bro, I think so. And he says, let's put on some music. You're like, bro, yeah. What are you thinking? You thinking what I'm thinking? Let's put on some Beethoven. You're like, yeah, some Ludwig von Beethoven. And you're sitting there listening to Beethoven, and you're hanging out there together, and you're like, man, everyone's like, does he really think it's pronounced Beethoven? You're listening to Ludwig von Beethoven, and you're getting through the Fifth Symphony and the Moonlight Sonata, and you say, oh, this is my favorite part here, and you're listening to it. And you say, boy, I just really love Beethoven's music. And your friend says, well, I don't think that Beethoven ever existed. You say, well, I believe that he did. And he says, no, I don't believe that he did. And you say, well, how do you figure? And he says, well, I don't need to believe Beethoven existed in order to enjoy his music. In fact, I was a music major. I can play Beethoven. You can't. I can read Beethoven's music. I can pick out some of the harmonies and the movements and the staccato. I can pick all that out. I actually know more about this music than you do, and I enjoy it more. Well, that's all true. That's all true. You don't need to believe in Beethoven to enjoy his music. But if Beethoven never existed, we wouldn't have his music. So we're all agreeing that no matter who you are, what kind of person you are, what worldview you have, you can perceive moral values and duties. What's under discussion here tonight is the question of what is the foundation, theism or naturalism? Well, I'd like to give you an argument. This is a deductive argument. What this means is that the premises lead to a conclusion. This is a modus tollens form. If A, then B, not B, therefore not A. This is internally valid. So if premise one and premise two are true, you can't say, well, I don't think that premise three is true. No, premise three 100% certainly follows. If you want to argue against the argument, I'll tell you how to do it, okay? I'll give you some help. The way to argue against it is to say that either premise one or premise two is false. And that's what I'm going to do here tonight. I'm going to argue that these two premises are true. I'd like to make a deal with you tonight. What I would like to do is I'm going to do my part. I'm going to do my best to explain morality from a Christian worldview. But what I'd like to ask from you here tonight is that you would just have an open mind, that you would just consider, could this be true? Could this be true? Let's get started with that first premise. If naturalism is true, objective moral values and duties do not exist. And I'm going to give three reasons why. Number one, that there is a problem with intrinsic human value. Number two, the is-ought problem, or Hume's guillotine, as it's been called. And number three, determinism. Let's get started with that first problem. Intrinsic human value on a naturalistic worldview. Let's think about the species Homo sapien, a sack of muscles and juices and chemicals that are put together in a sack of skin. What is it about the human species that is intrinsically morally valuable? Well, what would we need to have something be intrinsically morally valuable about humans? Well, I'd like to contend that we need two things. First, we need something that's objectively true about human persons. And two, something that's truly important. So it's objectively true that human beings have two arms, two legs, and one belly button. But that's not truly important. For example, if somebody had one less appendage than the rest of us, they wouldn't be less valuable. If somebody had two kidneys and somebody had one, that wouldn't make one person more valuable than another. Why? Because it's just not important. Likewise, men and women wouldn't be equal value because they have different body parts. And if you need an explanation on that, you can go back to 10th grade health class for a discussion. Let's think of some of the differences about humans. Is it what? That we walk upright? I sure like that opposable thumb that we have. Dexterity? Is it what? Is it some kind of physical property about humans that makes them valuable? That can't be it. Is it our intelligence? Well, you say, yes, somebody like a Stephen Hawking is more valuable because he has more of an intelligence. Last I heard before he passed away, Hawking had an IQ of 190, maybe higher. Once you get to 190, it's like, we don't know what to do with you, okay? But we're not talking about instrumental value. Instrumental, like using someone as an instrument for an end. We're saying intrinsic, that just the person, him or herself, is valuable. So if you're going to hire somebody for a job, you might say that one person is more instrumentally valuable to work at this company, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about intrinsic human value. So if we had Stephen Hawking and Forrest Gump, to make a reference from 25 years ago in cinema, if we had these two sitting next to each other, would we say that one of them is more valuable than another because one of them has an IQ that is three times higher than the other? That can't be it. What about sentience? This has been real popular in the philosophical literature. Sentience, if you read six different definitions, you get seven different answers. It's kind of difficult to define. Sentience, to give a really basic understanding, is to be able to perceive thoughts, to not just have thoughts, but to know that you're thinking, to perceive emotions, and to perceive pain or pleasure. But that can't be it, because what about people who lack sentience? What about somebody who is anesthetized? What about somebody who's in a coma? What about persons who are recently born, infants, who lack sentience? They don't have that third order consciousness, not just the thought that I'm having, but that I am having a thought. Newborn infants don't have that. What about people who are severely mentally handicapped? That can't be the reason. Well, if we point to any one of these attributes of humans, one of the basic problems that we face is speciesism. You might say, what's that? Well, if racism is the unjustified valuing of one race over another, and if sexism is the unjustified valuing of one sex over another, speciesism would be the unjustified raising of one species over another. That is to say, why would we imbue, why would we value and confer value to the Homo sapien species? Don't believe me? Richard Dawkins, the atheistic biologist, in his 2004 book, The Devil's Chaplain, says this. He says, human beings, referring to value of human beings, he says this is flagrant speciesism. He says later, quote, human speciest vanity. The thought that you're going to look at all the species and say, well, that one species, that's the one that's really valuable. On what basis do you do so? Asks Richard Dawkins. Peter Singer, the atheistic bioethicist at Princeton University, he says, humans who bestow superior value on the lives of all human beings solely because they are members of our own species are judging along lines strikingly similar to those used by white racists who bestow superior value on the lives of other whites. Merely, why? Because they are members of their own race. Why should we believe, Singer asks, that the mere fact that a being is a member of the species Homo sapiens endows its life with some unique, almost infinite value? Why indeed, given naturalism, why would we say of all the millions of species that one species has moral value? But the problem gets worse on a naturalistic worldview. What happens if we say that humans are valuable because of one of these physical properties? What happens if we take one or more of these away from a human being? Does that mean that we take away their moral value? Well, Peter Singer, again, this is from his book, Practical Ethics. Now, this I'm not quoting from atheistic websites here, okay? This is from a graduate textbook on ethics from an ethicist from Princeton. Singer says this, human babies are not born self-aware or capable of grasping that they exist over time. They are not persons. Do you see what he just did? He divorced being a human being from being a person. There's a bifurcation in Peter's worldview. Why? Because on his view, only those animals, either Homo sapiens or bonobos or chimpanzees who have sentience, those are the persons or the animals that have moral value. And so if a human being lacks sentience, that human being lacks moral value. What are the consequences of this view? Peter Singer says the life of a newborn is of less value than the life of a pig, a dog, or a chimpanzee. You might say, well, yes, they're potentially going to become of greater moral value. Yeah, but we're not talking about potentials. We're talking about actuals. When we're looking at that human baby, they're of less value. Jeffrey Ryman, another atheistic philosopher, he says the killing of infants is wrong. Oh, we agree. Good. Why? Because of an emotion that we naturally and rightly have toward infants. That is an intrinsic human value. That's extrinsic human value. That's that we value a human person, a baby, and so we confer that value onto them. It's not that they're valuable in and of themselves. And so Ryman writes, adults and children possess in their own right a property that makes it wrong to kill them. Infants, for the moment, do not. James Rachels, atheistic philosopher and ethicist. This is from his book, Created from Animals. He says, some unfortunate humans, perhaps because they have suffered brain damage, are no longer rational agents. What are we to say about them? Good question. What happens if we have a human being and you take away rationality? Then what? The natural conclusion, according to the doctrine we are considering, would be that their status is that of mere animals. And perhaps we should go on to conclude that they may be used as non-human animals are used, perhaps as laboratory subjects or as food. Now, I just want to tell you, you don't have this book sitting in front of you. I read the context for that statement. That's what he meant. Okay? I'm quoting these authors faithfully. He says, of course, traditional moralists do not accept any such conclusion. Yeah? We should not treat a person worse merely because he has been so unfortunate, we might say, but this idea will not bear close inspection. Now, some people at this point will say, yes, but we have an alternative. What's that? Well, perhaps culture or society can give us moral value. Well, there's a difficulty with this. Imagine if I came up to you and I said, I, James Rochford, I value blank, whatever blank is. Would you have to value blank? Well, no. Good for you. There's 7.2 billion others of us out here. You can have your opinion about that. Like, you value one thing. That's your opinion. But the rest of us are out here too. We have our own opinions. Now, what would happen if I said lots of people value blank? Well, if one person lacks the sufficiency to give something objective moral value, how is adding a bunch of other people going to give it moral value? Do you see what I'm saying? If you have one zero and then you add a 7.2 billion other zeros, what do you have? Zero. Think about it like this. We look at this $100 bill and we say, that's valuable. Oh yeah, it is. I wish somebody would come up to me after this and give me one of those. That's valuable. But is it intrinsically morally valuable? I don't see how. Now, as a culture, we confer value to it. We give it value. But it itself is just a green piece of paper. It's a material piece of paper. Now you say, well, we're doing pretty good. I mean, everyone agrees that it has that value, and so we're doing pretty stable, and in that sense, it's objective. No, it isn't. What happens if we go through another Great Depression? What happens if you were living in post-World War II Germany, where inflation had skyrocketed so high that they were taking those little green pieces of paper by the bucketful down to the store just to buy a loaf of bread? If there was some kind of financial crash, that green piece of paper would turn into a green piece of toilet paper. It could immediately lose value that quickly. And so by saying we all agree on such and such doesn't make it true. Let's think about our second problem. This is called the is-ought problem. The is-ought problem. Let's start with this proposition here. Everything in nature is natural. You're like, I paid money to see this guy. Everything in nature is natural. What's the point? What are you getting at? Well, let's think about this. Let's think about this. Premise one, every event in the universe is natural. Duh. Yeah. Moral atrocities are events in the universe. Therefore, three, moral atrocities are natural. If naturalism is true, this seems to follow. Every event in the universe is natural. Moral atrocities are events like any other. Therefore, moral atrocities are natural. How do we go from nature, what is the case, to what ought be the case? Let's think about the naturalist creation story. Of course, we would agree on this first premise here. The Big Bang started 13.6 billion years ago. But where we disagree is that the Big Bang, or no, I guess we would agree, the Big Bang isn't a moral cause. It's not a moral producer. It's not that bangs or explosions create some kind of moral ends. So we had a non-moral producer, a non-moral beginning. Consequently, after all of the Big Bang debris came back together and clustered into stars and planets and carbon atoms and so forth, then we had the non-moral process of neo-Darwinism. This isn't supernatural selection. This is natural selection acting on random mutation, producing the extraordinary diversity of life. So the question is, how can you go from a non-moral producer, from a non-moral process, to a moral product, namely Homo sapiens? If there's a non-moral beginning and a non-moral middle, how do you get a moral end? Well, some people say, well, therein lies your answer, neo-Darwinism. Darwinism can actually account for objective moral values and duties. I would contest that. I would contest that severely. Let me tell you why. Here's Michael Shermer. He's the founder of the Skeptic Society. He's a PhD in the history of science. This is from his book, The Science of Good and Evil. Let's see what he says. He says, the moral sense of feeling good or feeling bad about behavior X, whatever X may be, is an evolved human universal. So he's saying, how do we know that morality is objective? Because the neo-Darwinian synthesis, working through cooperative primates and moving into clusters of people and having acts of reciprocity, and somehow it created and selected for lining up feeling good with doing good. You see what he's saying? And this is a human universal. By virtue of the fact that you're a human that was created by this process, therefore you have these impulses from evolution. He says, by a moral sense, I mean a moral feeling or emotion generated by actions. Why should we be moral, he says, is like asking, why should we be hungry or why should we be horny? What he's doing here is saying that we have these natural impulses, okay? I have an urge, an impulse, a throb to eat food or to be horny. And so what's he comparing it with? With morality, with altruism, being sacrificial, being loving. Why would I do that? Because there's an urge, a throb, an impulse that was given to us through natural selection and was selected for to make us want to do what is good and sacrificial. Here's Franz de Waal. He's an atheistic primatologist. He says evolution selected for a, quote, benevolent, that is a good impulse. A benevolent impulse. He asks this, doing good feels good. Why can't sacrificial love, altruism, be like any other natural human tendency in that it yields pleasure? I would like to contend that there's more problems with that sentence than there are words. Doing good feels good. Why can't altruism be like any other natural human tendency in that it yields pleasure? First of all, what this is admitting is that this is not objective. If you're saying that morality came from evolution, evolution by definition is change over time. That, therefore, it cannot, by definition, be objective, because evolution implies change. So we're not talking about the same thing. We're using the same vocabulary. We're using different dictionaries. When we speak about morality, one is saying objective, another is saying subjective. This is arguing in a circle. It's saying, why can't doing good feel good? The question isn't, why does doing good feel good? The question is, what is the good? How do we account for the good? You're assuming what you're trying to prove. That's what you're doing. It begs the question. It doesn't account for moral praise. So one person has an impulse or a throb or an urge to do something good. And so what are we supposed to do? That is a good person. He served with Doctors Without Borders. She is a good person. She helps little kids after school with their homework. How could you morally praise an individual? It would be like praising somebody for having blonde hair and blue eyes, a physical property that they couldn't have had otherwise. This also confuses description with prescription. The neo-Darwinian synthesis, evolution, describes how life came to be and even certain social properties in the species Homo sapiens. It describes that, but it does not prescribe anything. You see where we're at? An is versus an ought. You can describe nature, but you can't prescribe the way that it ought to be. My final question for this view is, what if a sadistic impulse or urge or throb overpowers a sacrificial impulse or urge or throb? If these impulses were programmed into us through Darwinism, what happens if somebody has a more powerful sadistic impulse? Let me put that a different way. Mother Teresa had one set of impulses. Jeffrey Dahmer had another set. Which ones were right? If you're reducing morality to impulses, there is no way to adjudicate, to tell the difference between two different impulses. Impulses are just physiological products, and they don't have moral properties. Here's Sam Harris from The Moral Landscape. He says, perhaps there is no connection between being good and feeling good. That could be just as possible, given evolution. He says, in this case, rapists, liars, and thieves would experience the same depth of happiness as the saints. He's affirming that that's the case. Now, he doesn't believe that's the case. He says, neurology tells us that usually doing something altruistic makes us feel good. Well, that would fit in the theistic universe as much as in a naturalistic universe, that God would want us to feel good about helping other people. Of course. But he's saying on a naturalistic universe, it could just be a coincidence that feeling good would line up with doing good. Michael Ruse and E.O. Wilson, one is an agnostic philosopher of science and the other is a Harvard biologist. They write this, ethics as we understand it is an illusion fobbed off on us by our genes in order to get us to cooperate. They write earlier, human beings function better if they are deceived by their genes into thinking that there is a disinterested, objective morality binding upon them, which all should obey. Are you seeing some repetition here? Were you here last night? Free will, what is it? It's an illusion. Consciousness, what is it? It's an illusion. Daniel Dennett's book is called Consciousness Explained. And in the book, do you know what he comes up with? It's an illusion. Terrible title, Daniel. Terrible title. It's like me writing a book, Europe Explored, only to tell you there is no such continent and there's no people ever going there to explore it. Ruse and Wilson say, it is easy to conceive of an alien intelligent species evolving rules its members consider highly moral, but which are repugnant to human beings. In the words of the late Stephen Jay Gould, the Harvard biologist, he said, if we rewound the wheel of Darwinism, we could have a totally different set of species with a totally different set of moral standards and behaviors. That's what they're saying here. Michael Ruse has an article that's called, Is Rape Wrong on Andromeda, the nearest star system? Well, if evolution went a different route, perhaps in their species, some other alien race, perhaps it wouldn't be wrong over there. Morally repugnant to human beings. Like what? What could you conceive of? They say such as cannibalism, incest, the love of darkness and decay, parricide, the killing of parents, and the mutual eating of feces. I don't know why they put that on there. I don't know if that's immoral. It's just gross. You know what I'm saying? Like, don't do that. I don't know if you should not. Just don't do that. Have some self-respect. Anyways, if human beings, they write, had evolved from a stock other than savanna-dwelling, carnivorous man-apes, we might do the same, feeling inwardly certain that such behaviors are natural and correct. Isn't that interesting? Why is it that we feel that this is the good? Well, it could have gone any other different way. That is not objective. Richard Dawkins, who's more Darwinistic than Darwin himself, he says, as I support Darwinism as a scientist, now catch this, I am a passionate anti-Darwinian when it comes to politics and how we should conduct our human affairs. He says, we alone are able to rebel against the selfish gene replicators. I'll leave it there. No, we cannot. You cannot say, well, evolution accounted for it. When you're saying it accounted for morality, again, same vocabulary, different dictionary. That is not what we're referring to. Under a naturalistic worldview, the real world is identical to the ideal world. It is what it is, as people so commonly say. Nature is. We can't say that it isn't, shouldn't have been that way. Naturalism is the way that it is. Unless we smuggle in moral assumptions. And in the literature on this, one of the things you'll pick up very quickly is they'll say, science can prove morality, or evolution can prove morality, or this can prove morality. And guess what they do? Sam Harris does this in his book. He says how science can determine morality. And he starts his thesis by smuggling in moral assumptions. In other words, don't look behind the curtain. I'm just going to smuggle these in without anyone noticing. So to go from an ought to an is, do you know how they do it? They say something like this. If you want to be a social worker, you objectively ought to go to college for 4 years. So they say, yeah, it is, if it is the case you want to be a social worker, you ought to go to college. Do you see the problem with that? You could just as easily switch out social worker for anything. If you want to become a bank robber, it objectively is the case that you ought to learn how to crack safes. There you go. I went from an ought to an is. Yeah, but I don't want bank robbers around. That's immoral. How do we know which one's moral and which one's immoral? That's the very question in front of us. Number three, determinism. Every event in the universe is determined by natural laws. I think that's a fair statement, given naturalism. Our thoughts and decisions are events in the universe. Therefore, our thoughts and decisions are determined by natural laws. Well, people object to this. They say, well, our brains are far more complex than other processes in the natural world. Yeah, they're more complex, but are they any more free? Imagine if I had 50 dominoes up on this table and I clicked the first one over and click, 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 50 dominoes went down. Now imagine I had 50,000 dominoes all lined up around this room and I clicked the first one, click, 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 all the way around for several minutes or hours or however long it takes to knock over 50,000 dominoes. Which one of those sets of dominoes was more complex? The second. Which one of those sets was more free? Neither. Adding complexity doesn't add freedom. In fact, many of the leading atheistic thinkers concede that because atheism is true, naturalism is true, free will is, quote, an illusion. I wish we had time to unpack this, but there's the sources that they say there is no such thing as free will. It's an illusion. Now, you might ask yourself, well, what does all this have to do with morality? Everything. Everything. Because if we're not free moral agents, then we can't be held culpable for what we do. Here's Sam Harris. He doesn't believe in free will. He says, the moment we catch sight of the stream of causes that precede their conscious decisions, he's talking about criminals, reaching back into childhood and beyond, their culpability begins to disappear. They're no longer culpable. They're no longer morally responsible. Think of Fyodor Dostoevsky's book, Crime and Punishment. Sam Harris would revisit that and say it's crime and effects. Crime and no punishment. Culpability. Now imagine if we're standing here, you know, out in the lobby and we're hanging out talking and somebody pushes me into you and you spill your coffee. Who would you blame? Well, not me. I'm just the mass of flesh and pale skin that bumped into you, right? The person who put the causal agent who pushed me into you is the one responsible. Well, what if everything that we are is just a series of causal agents that are determined? Then there is no punishment. There is no culpability. Here's Jerry Coyne, atheistic biologist at the University of Chicago. He says, by losing free will, we gain empathy. Really? How so? For we realize that in the end, all of us, whether Bernie Madoffs or Nelson Mandelas, are victims of circumstance. Do you know who Bernie Madoff was? Is? He stole $64 billion worth of people's money and retirements and pensions. That's who Bernie Madoff is. He's saying he's the victim. With that under our belts, we can go about building a kinder world. Jerry, kinder for whom? Richard Dawkins wrote this. He said, when a computer malfunctions, we do not punish it. I mean, sometimes we do, don't we? We track down the problem and fix it. Yeah, it's probably better. Usually by replacing a damaged component either in hardware or software. Isn't the murderer or the rapist just a machine with a defective component? You see what he's saying? We might be a moist robot. We might be a modified primate. But really, we're an electrochemical, biological machine reduced to our primal substances. That's all we are. Aren't we just machines? Don't they just have a defective upbringing, defective education, defective genes? Why is it that we humans find it almost impossible to accept such conclusions? Why do we vent such visceral hatred on child murderers when we should simply regard them as faulty units that need fixing or replacing? My dangerous idea is that we shall eventually grow out of all of this and even learn to laugh at it, just as we laugh at a man when he beats his car. Murderers, rapists, he says, but I fear it is unlikely that I shall ever reach that level of enlightenment. Enlightenment is what he calls it. Huh? Now, these three problems for naturalism, let me just point out real quickly, they are not a problem for theism. Intrinsic human value. Why is it that human persons have intrinsic value? Because that we know there is an infinite personal God who has made each individual person, man, woman, boy, girl, in his image. He loves each individual person so much that he sent Jesus Christ to die for him or her, every man, woman, boy, and girl. Now, what do we have there? We have something that's objectively true and something that's truly important. If that's not truly important, I don't know what is. That the infinite personal God imbues and invests and loves human beings to that extent. The is-ought problem. This is only a problem if you're a naturalist, that it is what it is. But if you believe that there is something outside of nature, that the real world is not identical to the ideal world, that we can actually move towards something because we're free moral agents, which fits consistently in a biblical worldview. Oh, no. We would not have problems here whatsoever. So it seems to me that this first premise is true. If naturalism is true, objective moral values and duties do not exist. What about the second premise? Objective moral values and duties do exist. Now you might be thinking to yourself, well, how are you going to prove this one? I'm not. You are. How do you know if something is true? How do you know if something is real? One of the ways to know it is just to perceive it. It's just to have a first person, personal perception of the thing in question, to be able to see it. Think about this, the Rwandan genocide, which is over 20 years old at this point. In the Rwandan genocide, the Hutu majority killed 800,000 Tutsi in 100 days, a period of 3 months. That was more deaths per day for 3 months than in any 3 months of the Holocaust. 6 people per minute for 3 months, or to put that in perspective, about half of the people in this room. And they did it with machete. They hacked people down with machete, the Rwandan genocide. Now, let me ask you a question. Your direct, first-person, personal intuition and perception, how do you view this? Do you view this as Richard Dawkins does, that eventually we will grow out of all of this and we will learn to laugh at it? Do you believe that you'll eventually reach a state of enlightenment where you could look at 800,000 Tutsi killed by machete and believe that that's enlightenment? Now you might say, well, not everyone believes that. I'm not asking about everyone. I'm asking about you. What is your perception of that? What would you call that? Here's baby Riley. He was discovered, he's an 8-month-old baby. He was discovered in an apartment complex as his parents were throwing a rager party, and over the loud booming music and the drug smoke coming through this apartment, some of their friends found that baby Riley was screaming from the bedroom. They came in to find an 8-month-old emaciated baby. The parents went on record to say that they were, quote, too lazy and too busy to feed him. What is your perception of that? Well, not everyone would agree with that. I'm not asking about everyone. I'm asking about you. What is your first person direct perception of that? 2014, Indian police, as well as a gang of men, raped and hanged 2 Indian women, 14 and 15 years old. You know what the community did? They were so outraged at this that they said, we will not cut those women down. until we have justice. What is your perception of that? What would you tell those families? Well, it's just subjective. I mean, I wouldn't do that to your daughters. I don't think that that's right, but I mean, who am I to say? Who am I to judge? What about Emmett Till? You know Emmett Till? Emmett Till one day was a young teenage black youth who walked into a drugstore and apparently had catcalled at a white woman. Well, several of the white men in the rural South came to his house at gunpoint, grabbed Emmett Till, tortured him, beat him, and killed him, and threw his body into a river. The all-white jury let those two men off. The mother eventually found the body of her son, and they said, "Mamie," which was her name, "we need to have a closed casket." And she said, "No, I'm going to have an open casket." And they asked her why, and she said, "Let the people see what I've seen." If the white majority in the 1950s could just see with their own eyes, if they could just perceive the cruelty, the marginalization, the torture, the racism, if they could just see it, they could know it. Well, for 1950, this photo went viral. It went all over the country, and this was really responsible for the modern civil rights movement. And what did it come from? From seeing evil itself. We could compare this with sensory perception. What if somebody said, "Well, I just don't believe that we can see things around us." They call this solipsism, that we're just a brain in a vat, or maybe you're plugged into the Matrix, or Descartes, we're being deceived by demons, or you know, maybe you're just like some kind of a brain and nothing's really out there. How would you argue against a person like that? I mean, one way would be to say, you know, "I'm here, I'm touching you, I'm real." "Yeah, but that could just be my brain tricking me." I mean, science. "Yeah, but that could be my brain tricking me that we're looking at these scientific findings." I mean, somebody who's arguing against sensory perception, you would say, "Give me a break. Come on, pal." I mean, but what if somebody was arguing against moral perception? You might say, "Well, are you 100% certain that there's an external world, that the universe wasn't created 5 minutes ago with the appearance of age and built-in memories?" "I'm not 100% certain. No, I'm not. But I'm really, really, really certain." What about moral values and duties? Are you 100% certain that torturing babies for fun is wrong? I actually might be more certain of that than I am of the sensory perception, actually. Years ago, somebody came out with the report. They said, "Pluto is no longer a planet." You know what I did? I was like, "What's for breakfast?" You know, it didn't bother me one bit. Now, what if the news headline said, "Torturing babies for fun is not immoral"? You could argue that you could actually know scientific knowledge less certainly than moral knowledge. What about color blindness? Think about sensory perception or optical illusions. What number is up there? 15? Oh, 4.5% of you didn't know. And you just, I can tell you are because you just put your chin to your chest in shame. So let's say there's 1,000 people in this room and 45 of us can't perceive that number. Should the other 955 of us say that that number isn't up there? When it comes to perceiving morality, just because one person says, "Well, I don't agree with that," does that mean that the rest of us, it's incumbent upon us to say, "Well, I guess one person disagrees"? Actually, for some moral values, like torturing babies for fun, it wouldn't be 4.5% disagree. It'd probably be 0.000001% disagree, that we can perceive it. It's actually quite clear. And it's very hard to deny in practice. Remember Peter Singer? Remember his thesis was a utilitarian thesis that the majority of the value, what do you call it, talk, the pleasure of the most amount of people outweighs the pleasure of the few, utilitarianism. And so his definition of human personhood was that you have to be sentient, you have to be rational, and so forth, right? So he argues that actually infants can be killed He argues that people who reach senility, they've lost sentience and they've lost rationality. They could be killed. Guess what happened to Peter Singer? His mother came down with Alzheimer's. You know what he did to her? He went up into her bedroom late at night and with a pillow smushed it over her face. And I'm kidding. He didn't do that. Made that up. Okay. No, he didn't do that. You know what he did? He spent tens of thousands of dollars to take care of her. In the New Yorker in 1999, Michael Spector hit him with this inconsistency. He says, how about that? And Peter Singer said, I think that this has made me see how the issues of someone with these kinds of difficulties and problems are really very difficult. Perhaps it is more difficult than I thought before, because it is different when it's your mother. How about that? Now you might be saying, I'm putting that up there to make Peter Singer look like a hypocrite. I'm not. I'm saying that this man who has studied bioethics for a half a century in the academy, when he put that against his moral perception of killing his own mother, which thing won? His moral perception. He could see, I can't kill her. I agree with this philosopher here who said an ethical judgment that is no good in practice must suffer from a theoretical defect. If you can't live this out in practice, there must be something wrong with your theory. Who said that, by the way? Peter Singer said that. So now he's calling himself a hypocrite, so I don't have to. If morality is subjective, I have a few questions. Why does this change when we are the victims? Isn't that interesting? I really believe morality is subjective when I'm going out and stealing from other people. But when somebody steals from me, it becomes abundantly clear that was wrong. When somebody rips me off sexually, that's wrong. If I rip somebody else off sexually, well, sexuality, it's just, you know, it's relative. Why is it that when we're the victims, it becomes abundantly clear that this is real? Why are we torn over moral dilemmas? Like when people say we're in these moral dilemmas, should I steal it, should I not? Should I tell the truth? Should I stay safe? I don't know. Okay, that's like asking, if morality is subjective, that the dilemma is like, should I have the Reese's Cocoa Puffs or the Cheerios? It's just a matter of taste. Why are we torn? There'd be nothing to be torn over. Why is it that naturalists are always arguing about the problem of evil? In order for there to be evil, there needs to be good. But in order to have good and evil, you need some kind of a moral law to differentiate and adjudicate between the two. But in order to have a moral law, you need to have a moral lawgiver. But that's the very thing that they're trying to disprove, not to prove. Evil is a moral value, and moral values lead you to the locus, the source of moral value, which is God. If somebody was saying, well, I don't mean that evil's like really objectively wrong, I'm just saying it's subjectively wrong. Then really what you're saying is the problem of evil is like the problem of broccoli. How do you know God doesn't exist? Broccoli. What do you mean? I really don't like it. It's very distasteful to me. Well, that's just not going to suffice. That's your personal... But we all know what you mean. When you say, that, how could God allow so much evil? And there's good answers for that. That's just not our subject tonight. How could God allow so much evil? We know what you mean. You mean in the objective sense. But how can you hold that view at the same time holding that morality is subjective? Finally, why is it that the new atheists have made millions of dollars indicting the God of the Bible for immoral acts? Richard Dawkins says that the God of the Old Testament is the most bloodthirsty, masochistic, evil, malevolent person in all of fiction. That's what he says. How can you know that those things are immoral if you don't believe in immorality? Richard Dawkins was famous for saying that there is at bottom no evil, no good, no purpose, just blind, pitiless indifference. He says that in one book, and then in another book, he spends 400 pages excoriating the immoral evil acts in the Bible. So which is it? Which is it? Years ago, I was talking to a young agnostic student, And we were having a really good conversation. He's a real sweetheart of a guy. We're going back and forth. And at one point he said, I just don't believe that morality is objective. I believe it's subjective. I said, huh. But then he went on to talk about all these problems he had with the Bible. One of the problems he brought up, I'll never forget, was in 2 Kings chapter 2, where the prophet Elisha was walking through one of the cities in Israel, and these 42 youths come up to Elisha, the prophet, and they go up to him and they say, get out of here, baldy, go on up, go on up. And Elisha calls down a prayer from God, and two female bears come out of the woods and maul these 42 boys. So he hits me with this question and he says, yeah, what about that? And I actually had plenty to say to him. Actually, the word for youth in Hebrew is more like a teenager. There's 42 of them. There's one prophet. They weren't just calling him baldy in the sense they're making fun of him for being bald. To say that he has to go up was like go up like Elijah earlier in the chapter. We want you dead. We want you out of here. This was a youth gang coming in on the... Okay, I didn't go there though, okay? I've got plenty to say about that. I didn't go there. I said, wait a minute. You just told me that morality is subjective, not objective. He said, yeah, that's right. I said, then I have a question. What's wrong with bears eating boys? They were probably really hungry. It would have been equivalent to like a nice veal steak. These young boys. In naturalism, what's wrong with bears eating boys? And he said, well, it's wrong because you believe that God is loving and God is good. And so why would he do that? And I said, now, wait a minute. Let's pause for a second. Do you realize what you just said? You couldn't say that that was immoral, bears eating boys. What you had to do was erect my worldview. You had to erect a God you don't believe in to be able to call that wrong and then argue against it. So you're arguing against a God you don't believe in. Inconsistent, absolutely. What we could say here is morality isn't hard to know. For some, it's just hard to accept. I'll be frank, the moral life is hard. It is difficult. Anyone who says that the moral life is easy is lying. It is hard, and yet we can perceive it to be real. Well, if those first two premises are true, the third one follows logically and necessarily that naturalism is false. Which brings us to our conclusion for this evening. Which makes more sense? Let's end the way that we started. That personhood came from an impersonal universe. That values came from a valueless material set of properties. That duties came from determinism. In a sense, that morality came from matter. Does that make more sense to you? Or does it make more sense to believe that personhood came from a personal being, God? Values came from Him who is the source of all goodness and love. He's the standard against which we measure all goodness. The duties come from a moral lawgiver. No, we don't just have moral laws. They're just out there. Imagine going up to the pharmacist and saying, I have a prescription. And she says, okay, who prescribed it? No one prescribed it. Prescriptions need prescribers. Laws need lawgivers. This makes perfect sense on theism, that morality came from matter or that morality came from mind. Let me close with this. As you're trying to pick out your worldview, the purpose of a worldview is to explain the world, not to explain it away. Let me repeat that. The purpose of a worldview is to explain the world, not to explain it away. What do we do with morality? Do you believe it's just an illusion, a deception? Or do you believe that this is something that's real? Well, that's all I had for tonight. Why don't we get Paulie up here?
Can I have a seat? Some hard ones tonight. Some were mentioning studies about animals with altruistic tendencies, and perhaps we've evolved those too. If altruism is a fitness advantage, for us, Darwinistically, then is that morality?
Right. A lot of primatologists, Franz de Waal is one of them, have noted that in our closest primate cousins, bonobos, chimps, and apes, that they have certain troop behavior, social cooperation, and so forth. And they say, they make from this an assertion that perhaps humans have the same, yet more developed, ability to have social cooperation and morality. The difficulty with this is that when we look at a troop of baboons, we can see that they're capable of cooperative behavior, but we would not say that they're culpable for that behavior. So it's confusing capability with culpability. It also confuses description with prescription. When we look at the baboons, we're seeing something that's happening. The question is, which set of behaviors is right and which is wrong? We're already assuming what we're trying to prove. And so when we look at baboons at the Columbus Zoo, we might see that they're throwing feces at each other. No primatologist is going to argue, well, see, they do it, so therefore we should do it as well. See, it's already assuming the moral question, that some set of behaviors are right and some are wrong. What I will say is that the moral question with regard to humans is far more advanced and far more complicated than troop behavior and social cooperation in primates. And even if there was some kind of a precursor, there's a huge gap, and it still wouldn't answer the essential question in front of us.
Mm-hmm. All right. Decent.
Good. You want more?
No, it's good.
All right, we'll go.
Someone was like, why was this the third time I've heard a teaching here about babies being tortured for fun? Why couldn't just babies being tortured be good enough? And it brought up other, along with that, other people were like, does seem like there's a lot of morally gray areas.
Yeah.
You brought up the extremes that we are extremely confident about, but can objective moral reality be explained when we so much of morality is not clear?
Great question. Yeah, we do have cases where there are moral gray issues. No one would deny that. Do we give our money in philanthropy to the orphans in Cambodia, or do we give it to the AIDS victims in Somalia? Mm-hmm. There's moral gray issues. We know these, we perceive these, but let me just make a point. The fact that we have moral gray issues and we wrestle with them does not disprove that morality is real. It actually proves it. Because if these gray issues, if there were no answer, why would we feel torn over them? In any area of knowledge, when we're trying to study a subject, what we want to do is start with the basics and the foundation and then work our way in to the gray issues. So, for example, if you're studying mathematics, you don't start with calculus or advanced calculus. You start with addition, subtraction, and so forth. So you start with the basics and move inward to the more complex, not with the complex and move outward to the basics. And I think in the realm of ethics and moral theory, it's easier to start with the extremes where this is very clear and then work our way ethically into some of the unclear areas.
A couple of people brought up, seemed like a potential evolution of ethics throughout history, like, social justice in our, past couple centuries and cultural differences in moral standards.
Yeah.
Seems to point to maybe a lack of objective morality. How would you respond to that?
My response, well, that's actually two questions. So the first question is that we have morality that has been evolving. Mm-hmm. If there is no objective standard, what is it evolving toward? If I'm somebody who's a bowler and I keep throwing this ball at these pins every day, if I don't know that the standard is 300 for a bowling game, 12 strikes in a row, then I'm not getting better or worse. I'm just moving that number higher or lower. It's not moving toward any kind of goal. So the very fact that somebody would say that there has been a moral evolution, which I would agree, for example, with children's working rights, slavery, women's rights, and so forth, but that actually proves that there's a standard. Otherwise, we're not saying that we're making progress, we're just making change. And so forth. Mm-hmm. The second question, remind me of it again. What was it? The
cultural relativism.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay, in different cultures, they have different moral standards. Okay, there's two ways to answer this. The first way would be to say that in different cultures, it could be the case that they are less moral or more moral than others. And I think that's perfectly fine. I think we would agree on the personal level that individuals could be more moral or less moral than others, like an Adolf Hitler or a philanthropist of some kind. So why wouldn't that be the case with regard to cultures, entire cultures of people? Now, in a biblical worldview, this would make perfect sense because we could see that bad ideas, bad views would have bad consequences. And so no one would argue that we couldn't learn moral knowledge the way we do any other way, the way that we learn mathematics or we learn history or syntax and grammar. A lot of morality is taught, and if it's poorly taught and moral reasoning isn't taught, it's going to have consequences. Another way of answering it is to point out the work of C.S. Lewis in The Abolition of Man, James Rachels, of all people, the one who says that we should use the people as laboratory food and, what was it, laboratory food and, what was it?
Experiments,
that's what I said, yeah. Laboratory experiments. James Rachels has a whole section in his book of 110 moral virtues that are held across anthropology. And so he says that actually the differences aren't as much as you would think. It's usually on the periphery, not at the core. Things like taking care of children, truth-telling, things like that, where you can start to discover that we do have a lot more in common than you might think. And he's coming from an atheistic perspective, so it isn't as though a Christian is trying to say that.
And that the differences are peripheral rather than central.
Yeah, I mean, let me give you an example. We could both agree on a moral value, but we could disagree on the expression of that value. So how did Hitler convince Nazi Germany to kill 6 million Jews and homosexuals and gypsies and Catholics and everyone else? Yeah. How did he convince them to do that? He convinced them by saying, these people aren't human. Mm. Human persons have value. Mm-hmm. But the Nazis had a famous line, a life unworthy of life, where they had certain persons, the mentally handicapped, the sick, where he convinced them that because these aren't human persons, we shouldn't kill them. Mm-hmm. Now, would even Hitler, the most moral extreme that you could have, would even he admit that killing a German soldier in an unjustified way is immoral? Yes, he would. Mm. So the moral value, even in an extreme, and I know that's extreme, but even in an extreme case, the moral value could be the same, but the expression of that value could be different. Because what we're doing is changing the science and changing what a human person is. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Another good one was talking about how you appealed to people to look inside themselves to see whether or not this is objectively true.
Yeah.
Which sounds like a subjective call.
Yeah.
So how is the process of looking inside helping us arrive at something objective outside of us?
Yeah, I see what you're saying. What this is to know, that's epistemology, how to know something that is objectively true. That's ontology. So the way that we come into contact with anything that's real or ontological, that's out there in reality, is through subjective experience and knowledge. For the person to say, well, that's too subjective to be able to know morality in that way, my pushback would be that's how we know all things. How else do we know things in reality other than inside the human subject? Mm-hmm. So subjective, objective, there might be some confusion there where, of course, the subject is trying to perceive the object, but that's the only comparison you can have with subjectivism. Subjectivism is that we deny all objective truth.
Mm. Yeah, right. What else could we use rather than what we have?
Yeah.
Good point. Good questions, by the way.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys. Another one was talking about if God is the source of objective morality, then how come when we hear stories like about the bears eating the kids and we look in the Bible, there's so much attack on it morally.
Yeah.
If that's the source of more objective morality, how is it that we as humans approach it with judgment?
Right. Well, one thing I would say here is that the Bible isn't the source. God is the source. God's nature is the source. God has revealed his nature through the Bible. And so again, that's that ontology, epistemology thing. God is the source. He's revealed himself through the Bible. For people who look through scripture and say, well, I don't agree with that, or I don't agree with this, join the club. There are many times I'm reading through the Bible and I'm reading through it and it says, love your wife as Christ loved the church. And I want to say, no, I don't agree with that. Not today. Not after our last fight. It's hard. But one of the things that tells me is that this could be a sign that this is not an invented religion. In an invented religion, I would never read the book and have tension with it and feel like it's pushing back at me like a person, personal relationship. In a real religion where God is actually speaking back, he's pushing back and saying, no, you're the one in the wrong, not me. Mm. If we invented it, it would be, as Tim Keller puts it, it'd be like the Stepford Wives, where they're robots that just please their husbands and everything that they wish. Mm-hmm. That's not a personal relationship. Now, with regard to some of those big issues, the killing of the Canaanites and the bears and the boys, 2 Kings 2. I think I gave a little bit of an explanation for that. I would just direct you to two resources. The first would be Paul Copan's excellent book, Is God a Moral Monster? Which I found to be just blew my hair back. I thought it was fantastic. And John Wenham, his book, The Goodness of God, which is a little bit older. That's from 1974, but a fantastic book as well. So if you're really interested in some of these difficulties in the Bible, that would be a great place to start.
Lord, as I listen to James tonight, I sense the truth that you made us with value and with good. I pray for those here, Lord, that have checked out the conference and are checking you out, that you would speak to them directly, Lord, and show them your love and your goodness. Help us go out, Lord, with the message that we follow you, a God who is the God and the source of all good, the source of truth, the God who created this universe, Lord, that set it in motion, has organized it in just a way, Lord, so that we can enjoy you forever. Mm-hmm. We praise you for that.
Yes. Lord, I agree with those prayers. We're thankful for the great privilege of these last several days and the time together with each other and the teaching and the just happy love relationships we get to experience. Thank you for this. We look forward to next year. And Lord, as we close down tonight, we want to pray for our friends and guests who are sitting here with us, who maybe haven't made that decision to invite you into their lives. Even as we were talking about the moral good, it really goes to show that we don't live up to that. Mm. But thank you that you have made the barrier and the chasm crossed through the person of Jesus Christ. You've taken our place. We pray for anybody here tonight who hasn't personally received that into their lives. We pray that they would just have the courage to open up their hearts and to call out to you and say, if you really are that good, I want to receive that for me. And we thank you for anybody who might have done that here with us tonight. In your son's name, amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.